This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Wow, Santa Fe, how's it going? Y'all hear me good? Yeah? Louder. Well, I'm really happy to be here tonight. My name is Clayton Thomas Mueller. I'm a Cree man from northern Manitoba, Canada, and I work with the Indigenous Environmental Network as their tar sands campaign director. Thank you. Yeah. And, for many years, we've been supporting frontline Indigenous communities who are fighting against the world's largest and most destructive project known as the Canadian tar sands. And, of course, this oil development has many, many tentacles. It's a monster, really, and there are pipelines that they are proposing from this monster that spread out all across Turtle Island, and shipping lanes, new refineries. And in a time of the climate crisis, we really need everybody's help. So make sure and check out our website and find out how you can get involved and stop in the fossil fuel sector. But I want to personally just also point out and attend a protocol and, acknowledge the local First Nations here in this territory, this beautiful sacred land. And just say, as a guest here in this territory, I'm very happy to be here. We've been very well taken care of. Tomorrow, we'll visit our friends up at Tsuki Pueblo and go and see some of the way that they've been, protecting and preserving that sacred relationship to Mother Earth in their own way at their farm there. So I'm really, really excited about that. And I wanted to acknowledge those people of this land and, of course, those ancestors. And so, from the bottom of my heart, welcome to In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom, the lecture series on political, economic, environmental, and human rights issues hosted by the Lannan Foundation. I'm really, really honored to be here, and wanted to give a big shout out to all my friends from Santa Fe, especially the Bioneers community, anybody out there. So, but let's cut to the chase. We got a beautiful evening tonight planned. It's really quite an honor for me to share the stage with the leader and thinker and just inspiring person that I'm about to introduce this evening. And later on tonight, after his presentation, him and I will have an opportunity to have an intergenerational dialogue on some of the issues that he'll be bringing up this evening on the podium. Dr. David Suzuki is a scientist, he's an environmentalist, an author, a broadcaster, and co-founder of the David Suzuki Foundation, established in 1990 to work with government, business, and individuals to conserve our environment by providing scientific-based research, education, and policy work, and acting as a catalyst for change that today's situations demand. Recognized as a world leader in sustainable ecology, he is the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2009 Right Livelihood Award, the United Nations Environmental Program Global 500 Award, and UNESCO's Kalinga Prize for the popularization of science. Host of the long-running Canadian Broadcasting Corporation television program, The Nature of Things, he is also the author of more than 50 books. His newest, I know, eh? His newest work is Everything Under the Sun, Toward a Brighter Future on a Small Blue Planet, co-authored with his friend Ian Hannigson. Dr. Suzuki is a professor emeritus at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And before I bring him out here, let me just say that, like so many other First Nations and Canadian people, I grew up watching this guy on TV, and, I can honestly say, I grew up saying, I want to be that guy. That's who I want to do what he does. I want to fight to save Mother Earth. And so he popularized science. He popularized taking action, for me in my life path. And, I spend every single day now taking it to big oil. And a lot of reason that I do that is because of the inspiration I got from watching Dr. Suzuki on CBC, our Canadian public broadcasting channel in Canada. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Suzuki here to Santa Fe, to the Lensic Center.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Clayton, we've got a lot to talk about after this talk. I'm honored and I'm delighted to have the opportunity this evening to share a few ideas with you. I first, please allow me to acknowledge and thank the Lannan Foundation for its generous support of many of our initiatives with First Nations in British Columbia. The Lannan Foundation has had an enormous impact in Canada, I can tell you. I want to speak to you today as an elder. You see, at my age, no one can accuse me of having a drive for power or money or fame. Those are passé. Anybody who's an elder that's still after that, he's got a problem, I would think. And now that testosterone levels are dropping, so I don't think about sex all the time, I'm getting really smart. I believe elders have a very special place because we have something no other group in society has. We have had the experience of living an entire lifetime. Elders have suffered setbacks, I'm sure. We've made a lot of mistakes, celebrated a few successes. Our lives are full of lessons, lessons vital to pass on to the coming generation. So I urge my fellow elders to get off the couch, get off the golf course, and get on with the most important part of your lives. You see, we are at a remarkable moment in all of human history when what we do or do not do in the next few years will determine whether our species will survive into the next century. Now, that sounds like a pretty melodramatic statement. Don't take my word for it. How about Sir Martin Rees, the royal astronomer in England and eminent scientist who was asked on BBC a few years ago, what are the chances that human beings will be around by the end of this century? And his answer was 50-50. James Lovelock, the man who coined the term Gaia to explain life on the planet, has written a book in which he says by the end of this century, 90% of humanity will be gone. And finally, Clive Hamilton, an eco-philosopher from Australia, a man I have enormous respect for, has written a book called Requiem for a Species. And guess what species it's a requiem for? These are some of the people among many of my colleagues who are saying it's too late. We've passed too many tipping points to go back and to make out along a different path. What I say to those who say it's too late, thank you for giving us the message of the urgency of dealing with these issues we're trying to grapple with. But then please shut up and go away, because I don't see the point of saying it's too late. First of all, I don't think we know enough to say it's too late. But secondarily, even if it was, we're going to fight to the end to make a better world anyway. So what's the point? Today, human beings have become such a powerful force collectively that we are now altering the physical, chemical, and biological properties of the planet on a geological scale. That's why the Nobel laureate, Paul Crutzen, has said this is the Anthropocene epoch, a period during which one species, humanity, has become a geological force. The question is, how did we arrive at this amazing moment in time? I'm a geneticist by training, so I've been astounded to watch the way scientists have used DNA to track or trace the movement of our species over time. And all of the trails lead back to Africa 150,000 years ago. I can't wait to be invited by the Ku Klux Klan to give a lecture and tell these pointy-headed characters, we're all Africans, for heaven's sakes. That's where we were born. Try to imagine the world when our species appeared. There were still woolly mammoths on the planet. There were saber-toothed tigers. The world was a very different place. And I imagine that the great savannas of Africa must have been filled with animals in abundance and variety beyond anything we can imagine from the Serengeti today. And here and there were little pockets of three, four, five of these funny-looking two-legged naked apes, and that was us. Now, I'm sure no other species looked at us, trembled, and said, watch out for them. They're going to take over the planet. I mean, what did we have going for us? There weren't many of us. We weren't big, fast, strong. We didn't have special senses. And the point is that our secret, the key to our great success, was not visible. It was a 2-kilogram organ buried deep in our skulls. The human brain that conferred a massive memory, curiosity, and inventiveness. That brain enabled us to create order out of chaos in the world that we saw around. That brain learned by trial and error. And it did something no other species has ever done. It invented an idea called the future. Future doesn't exist. Just what exists is now and what we remember from the past. But because we invented the notion of a future, we are the only creature that realized we could shape the future by what we do today. Based on our experience and knowledge, we can look ahead, see where the dangers lie, see where the opportunities are, and deliberately decide today to avoid dangers and exploit opportunities. I believe foresight was the great advantage that we had over any other creatures. And because of foresight, we were able to move across the planet and occupy every continent, and become the dominant creature on Earth. And suddenly, very, very suddenly, we have exploded into a geological force. If we were around as a species for 150,000 years, there were never a billion human beings for most of that period. It wasn't until the early 1800s that there were a billion human beings on the planet. I was born in 1936, when there were just over 2 billion people. Can you imagine that within my lifetime, within a single human life, the population has more than tripled? And every one of the 7 billion of us now has to breathe air, drink water, eat food, clothe and shelter ourselves. So just the act of living, staying alive, means that we have an enormous ecological footprint. That is, it takes a lot of air, water and land to support 7 billion of us. We are the most numerous mammal on the planet. But of course, we're not like rabbits or rats or mice. We have an enormous amount of technology used on our behalf. As I look out, I have to squint to see you all out there, but as I look out at the audience, I see a lot of people in wool and cotton clothes. I am absolutely sure there isn't a single one of you with a flock of sheep in your backyard or growing a field of cotton plants. It's technology that enables us to live as we do, to live in Santa Fe, far beyond the capacity of this area to support the population that you have. It's technology and the ability to deliver materials that we need from all over the world. And that amplifies, through technology, our ecological footprint. And of course, we have an economy now based on consumption, where 70% of the North American economy depends on consumer products. 97% of American teenage girls now consider shopping their number one recreation. Shopping, consuming is what we are about today, and that everything that we consume comes out of the earth. And when we're done with it, we throw it back in. And that, again, escalates our ecological footprint. And finally, we have a global economy that exploits the entire planet as a source of raw materials that deposits our waste and toxic materials back into that planet. So when you add all of those things up, our numbers, our technology, our consumption, and a global economy, we have become a global force on the planet that is now collectively undermining the very life support systems of the planet. Scientists for over 40 years have been acting in the best tradition of our species, using their knowledge and expertise, using supercomputers, and looking ahead, seeing where the dangers lie and the opportunities are. And for over 40 years, they've been telling us we are headed down a very dangerous path. Let me give you one example of the kind of warnings that we've been receiving. This is a document that was published in November of 1992. It's called World Scientists Warning to Humanity. And when you look at the list of scientists, these are the top scientists of the world, more than 1,700 scientists from 71 countries in the world, including over half of all living Nobel Prize winners at that time. So it's a pretty impressive group of people. What are they warning us about in 1992? Let me read you from the document. Human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future we wish for human society and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. And then they go on and list the areas of collision: the atmosphere, water resources, oceans, soil, forests, species, and population. And then the words grow even more bleak. No more than one or a few decades remain before the chance to avert the threats we now confront will be lost, and the prospects for humanity immeasurably diminished. A great change in our stewardship of the earth and life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated. And then they tell us the five things that we must do and begin immediately. This is a frightening document. But I'll tell you, scientists are not in the business of signing such strongly worded documents. But if this is frightening, the response of the media around the world was terrifying. There was no response. In Canada, our national newspaper and our national broadcaster, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, dismissed this as not newsworthy. Excuse me, over half of all Nobel Prize winners saying we may have as little as 10 years to avoid a catastrophe, and this is not newsworthy. And let's remind ourselves of what is newsworthy. You ever heard of Brad and Angelina? You ever heard of Lindsay Lohan? Think of the sports, Lance Armstrong and who won the World Series. And of course, every pronouncement from an economist or a corporate executive is reported in breathless detail, but not when half of all Nobel Prize winners tell us we face a catastrophe. And I must say, listening to the debates in the United States over the last couple of months, I have to say it doesn't sound much different now than it did in 1992 when this document occurred. Why in the world can't we see what's happening? The powerful position we've acquired and the warnings of the leading scientists of the world about the dangers that we now confront, especially in the area of global warming. Well, I believe the problem is that the way we see the world through the perspective of our values and our beliefs. And it is our current worldview, that perspective today, that is the cause of our destructiveness. In the environmental movement has fundamentally failed to shift the way that we see the world and ourselves in it. We call this a paradigm shift. We haven't brought it about. And this year, as you know, is the 50th anniversary of the modern environmental movement. Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962. We see the world through the lenses of our values and our beliefs. Many years ago, I visited a tiny village on the side of a mountain in the Andes in Peru. And I learned that the children in this village are taught that the mountain their village is on is an Apu. Apu in their language means God. And as long as that Apu casts its shadow on the village, it will determine the destiny of everyone in that village. And I thought, wow, imagine the way those kids, when they grow up, treat that mountain compared to someone from Gunnison, Colorado, who grows up in the Rockies, taught all his life that those mountains are full of gold or silver. Is a forest a sacred grove or simply lumber and pulp? Is a river the circulatory system of the land, or is it simply an opportunity for power or irrigation? Is another species our biological relative or simply a resource? Is the soil a community of organisms or just dirt? Is the biosphere our home or is it simply an opportunity? The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it. For 95% of human existence, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. And when you're a nomad following plants and animals through the seasons, you know very, very well that we are utterly dependent on the natural world for our survival and well-being. So for most of human existence, we understood our place in nature and our dependence on nature. In the last 5% of our existence, the last 10,000 years, we had the agricultural revolution that transformed the way that humanity lives. For most of that last 10,000 years, we've been a farming species. In 1900, when there were 1.5 billion people in the world, most people in the world, including in North America, lived in rural village communities. You could find all through the Midwest tiny communities of 150, 200 people living, spotted all across the Midwest. Why? Because we were farmers. Because most people in the world were involved in some aspect of agriculture. Farmers understand very well the seasons, weather, climate. We're utterly dependent on these for our well-being and our survival. Farmers know the amount of snow in the winter is directly related to the amount of moisture in the soil in the summer. Farmers know some insects are pests, but we need insects to pollinate flowering plants. They know that some species of plants and trees take nitrogen from the air, fix it as fertilizer in the soil. Farmers understand that we are dependent on the natural world. Something fundamentally different happened in the last 100 years. By the year 2000, when there were now 6 billion people in the world, there were 80 to 85% of us living in the industrialized countries now lived in big cities. Over half of all of humanity by the year 2000 lived in cities. So in only 100 years, we were changed from a farming animal into a big city dweller. And in a big city, it becomes easy to think we're not like other species. I mean, we're so smart, we create our own habitat. You know, and as long as we have a few parks out there where we can go camping and skiing and playing, who needs nature? You know, we're city folk. I have a friend that lives in the northern end of Toronto, biggest city in Canada. And he told me he lives in a high-rise apartment, completely air-conditioned. He said, I go down the elevator in the morning, get into my car in the basement, it's completely air-conditioned, drive down the Down Valley Freeway downtown into the basement of my commercial building, into an air-conditioned office. That building is connected through tunnels to all kinds of shopping areas and food markets. He said to me, David, I don't have to go outside for weeks. Who needs nature? We create our own habitat. And so as city dwellers, our highest priority becomes our job. We need a job to earn the money to buy the things that we want. Note I said want, not need. Because most of the stuff we buy, we don't need. It's just what we want. And so the economy then becomes our priority as an urban species. Now, we seem to forget that the very word economy comes from the Greek word oikos, meaning household or domain. Our domain as a species is the biosphere, the zone of air, water, and land where all living things exist. Economics is the management of our domain. Ecology comes from the same root word, and ecology is the study of our domain or our household. And what ecologists try to do is determine what are the conditions, the principles, and the laws that enable a species to survive and flourish. Now, I would have thought any organization, any corporation, any government, before beginning a new program, would say, wait a minute now, have you checked with those ecologists? Because we don't want to do anything that's going to violate those principles or those laws. But what we do is we say, no, we can't afford to do that. The economy then becomes even more important than the very principles that ecologists are telling us about. We elevate the economy when we say we can't afford to stop clear-cut logging. It's the only way we can be globally competitive. We can't afford to stop those trawlers that are dragging heavy weights across the bottom of the ocean because we can't compete with fishing fleets in other parts of the world. We can't afford to reduce greenhouse gases because it'll destroy the economy. So we elevate the economy above the very things that keep us alive. So let's put the eco back into economics. We seem to forget where that word came from. But if the economy is our highest priority, and certainly Mr. Romney and Mr. Obama indicated very strongly that was their highest priority, shouldn't we be asking a few fundamental questions like, what is an economy for? Are there no limits? What does all this growth in the economy mean to improve our lives? We keep saying it's got to have growth, but why? What good is that doing for us? How much is enough? Are we happier with all this stuff? I mean, we're not asking the fundamental questions that we should if the economy is indeed our highest priority. My great inspiration was Rachel Carson. Because of Rachel Carson, I became swept up in the environmental movement like millions of people around the world. And what I've, looking back over my life, being involved in environmental things, is that I was fortunate to be involved in a small way with a number of issues. For example, every time Congress threatened to put a rider on a bill that would allow Alaska to drill for oil in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, I cranked up the nature of things and we did a show about that area from an ecological standpoint. ANWR is the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou herd. And each time I like to think that our programs help to beat back the threat of drilling in ANWR. Don't clap right away because I've got the bottom line is not what you'd think because of Sarah Palin. I joined with the First Nations and there was a proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait, the narrow channel between Haida Gwaii and the mainland, and there are very treacherous waters. And we stopped the proposal to drill for oil. There was a proposal to bring Alaskan oil down along through the coast of British Columbia on the way to Seattle or Washington, and we stopped that. We stopped a dam on the at Site C on the Peace River. And Tara, my wife, and I joined with the Kayapo people in Brazil in a massive demonstration that stopped Brazil's program to build the Carau Dam in Altamira, Brazil. These we celebrated as great triumphs. But today, 30 to 35 years later, we are fighting the same battles that we celebrated as victories 35 years ago. Sarah Palin told us, it's drill, baby, drill. And Mr. Obama seems to be affected by that proposal. The proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait is back on. The dam at Site C on the Peace River and in Altamira are both being built now. And the pipeline from Alberta that will take the oil from the tar sands to the coast of British Columbia to load into supertankers. We banned supertankers, and now it's all back on the agenda. So what we celebrated as great victories were simply skirmishes that didn't fundamentally change the way that we see our relationship with the rest of the biosphere. We didn't shift the paradigm. And that's the reason many people are saying that the environmental movement, despite the enormous success in the first three decades, has fundamentally failed in what should have been our goal of shifting that paradigm. My environmentalism has developed over many decades now, fighting. We were fighting for cleaner air, cleaner water, fighting to protect forests, fighting for a better future. But the problem today is that when there's a fight, there's always a winner or loser. And now as we talk about the fate of the biosphere for humankind, I don't think that we can afford to have losers. And so the challenge, I believe, now is we've got to come together, but we've got to leave our vested interests outside the door. It doesn't work when we come together as stakeholders and try to fight it out over what program is going to win out. It involves compromise or sacrifice. We can't afford to do that. And I say we have to come together, and we now have to ask, can we begin from a position of agreement? Let's agree on the fundamental things on which we will build our platforms of politics or economics. So let's start by setting a bottom line that is dictated by the laws of nature. Thank you. We live in a world that is defined and shaped by laws of nature. Physicists tell us that we know that the speed of light puts a limit on how fast we can build a space rocket. We can't go faster than the speed of light. Nobody objects to that. You know, we live within that. We know that the law of gravity says you can't have an anti-gravity machine here on Earth. And we know the first and second laws of thermodynamics tell us that you can't build a perpetual motion machine. We all understand that. That's the world, the real world, that we live in. In chemistry, it's the same thing. There are laws governing the rate of reactions, diffusion constants, the atomic properties of the elements that determine the kinds of chemical reactions we can perform in a test tube, the kinds of molecules that we can synthesize. Those are all dictated to us by the laws of chemistry, and we live within those principles. In biology, it's the same thing. We know that there are carrying capacities of ecosystems, that ecosystems can flourish as long as predators, you know, with living within that ecosystem do not undermine the ability of those ecosystems to sustain themselves over time. Human beings are the most powerful predators on the planet, and we live at the very top of the ecological food chain. So that we have to pay attention to what are the carrying capacities of the various ecosystems around the world we occupy. That has to be the case. And the most important thing for us to remember and agree on is that we are biological creatures. And our biological nature dictates what our most fundamental needs are. We are animals. I gave a lecture in Austin, Texas, many years ago when they had the first annual Green Builders Association meeting. Big meeting. And I lectured to, I think there were 3,000 people. A lot of kids in the audience. And I said, you know, kids, if you remember one thing from this talk, remember we are animals. I was shocked. Their parents are so pissed off at me. Don't you dare call my daughter an animal. We're human beings. You know, we somehow feel that we're elevated above the rest of the living world. I mean, and you can see it. If you call someone a chicken or a pig or an ape or a snake or a worm, I mean, these are all insults, right? Because somehow we think we're, you know, above those other creatures. But you know, we are a species like any other species. And anybody in biology will tell you we belong to the kingdom Animalia. We belong to the phylum Chordata. We belong to the, phylum class, Mammalia, the order. Order may be above class. I'm not sure. Primates, hominidae, Homo sapiens. You can classify us all the way down to genus and species. We're an organism like any other creature. And because we are animals, our most fundamental need is dictated to us by that reality or that fact. The very first thing we needed the moment every one of us left our mother's body was a breath of air. And from that moment on, 15 to 40 times a minute, we need air until the last breath we take before we die. If we don't have air for 3 or 4 minutes, you're either dead or you're brain dead. If we have polluted air that we live within, you're sick. So I can't imagine anyone that could disagree with me that air is the most fundamental need that we have, that must be protected above anything else, will be the air that gives us life and lets us flourish throughout our lives. And then, of course, as animals, we are 70% water by weight. We're just a big blob of water with enough thickener added so we don't dribble away on the floor, right? And we have to top up all the time because water leaks out of our bodies and out of skin and our eyes and our mouth and our crotch, and we're losing water. And so, you know, we top it up with water. And where does that water come from? You think it's Santa Fe water? Of course not. The hydrologic cycle says water cartwheels around the planet. So when you take a drink of water, it contains molecules from every ocean on the planet, every canopy of forests around the world. And that water then, if you go without water for more than a few days, you're dead. If you drink polluted water, you're sick. So again, surely water should be right up there with air as our most fundamental need that we have to protect at all costs. And then, of course, without food for more than a few weeks, we're dead. If you eat food that's poisoned or polluted, you're sick. So every bit of the food that we eat for our nutrition was once alive, and most of it was grown in the soil. We take carcasses of plants and animals, tear them apart in our mouths, and incorporate the molecules in those plants and animals into our very essence. And we think that we're intelligent, but we use the soil as a garbage can for our toxic materials. Indeed, we will spray or inject toxic stuff into the plants or animals that we're going to eat. We are the earth through the food that we consume. Surely the earth should be one of our highest priorities. And every bit of the energy in our bodies, every bit of it that we need to move and grow and reproduce, all of that energy is sunlight. Sunlight captured by plants through photosynthesis and converted into chemical energy. And then we get that energy by eating the plants or eating the animals that eat that plants, and we store it in our bodies. And when we need that energy, we burn it to get the energy from the sun back out. So surely protecting photosynthetic activity around the planet is absolutely vital to our well-being and survival. And the amazing thing is, what delivers clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean food, and clean energy from the sun is the web of living things around the earth, what biologists call biodiversity. It's life itself that cleanses, replenishes, or creates the most fundamental needs that we have. To me, I defy any corporate leader, politician, anybody, even the Tea Party, I'm sure, would have to agree that as biological beings, air, water, soil, that photosynthesis and biodiversity have got to be in our best interests, our most fundamental needs that we have to protect and nourish. That's how we begin to build our system of needs, on which we then ask, how do we create an economy? How do we make a living? Protecting those absolutely fundamental needs. So those are realities dictated by the physical, chemical, and biological world, the principles that emerge from these sciences. Other things that we pay a lot of attention to are not in the same category. But we've puffed ourselves up so much, we think things that we create are more important than our most fundamental biological needs. We draw lines around our property, around our cities, our townships, our counties, our, our states and our countries. And boy, do we take those seriously. I gather in Texas, if someone comes onto your property, you can shoot and kill them. Because those property lines are bloody important. We go to war. We kill and die protecting those boundaries. But you know what? Nature couldn't give two hoots about human borders. I mean, I go to Alberta all the time and I tell Albertans, look, I don't care what you do with the tar sands. You can dig them up, burn them, poison the rivers and lakes. All I say is, whatever you do to the tar sands stays within Alberta. You guys think your boundaries are important. Keep it for yourselves. Well, of course, nature doesn't obey or pay any attention to our boundaries. When you think of the hydrologic cycle, water circulates, air blows around the planet. It's a single system. Dust blows from Africa across to North America. Then you think of all the migrating animals and plants that come across borders. Nature doesn't give two hoots about human borders. And yet we manage nature and we try to shoehorn nature into our boundaries. It's crazy because you can't do it that way. Nature doesn't operate that way. And then we go even further. We invent ideas like capitalism, like the economy, like corporations, the market. My God, you talk to a neoconservative, and they may seem perfectly normal until you finally you mention the market. Watch them. Their faces just light up. Their eyes glaze over, and they go, the market, hallelujah, praise the market, free the market, let the market do. Wait a minute now. We invented the damn thing. It's not a force of nature. You know, 300 years ago, people believed in dragons and demons. And they really believed in them. They would toss them gold and jewelry and sacrifice virgins, anything to keep the dragons or demons off their back. Well, today, nobody believes in dragons or demons. I mean, we know they're figments of our imagination. But what do? We replace them with another one. Just listen to the debates that went on for the last months. It's all about the economy. It's all about the free market. But these are inventions of the human mind. And yet, look at what we do. 2008... Mr. Bush, Mr. Obama tossed hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks that created the problem in the first place just to get that economy back up running. Wait a minute now. They're like dragons and demons, for heaven's sakes. We invented them. And if they don't work, those are the only things we can change. We can't change nature. So we've got to really look at the real world and see what is real and what are human constructs. You only have to look at what happened in Copenhagen 2 years ago. 192 countries gathered in Copenhagen to deal with the atmosphere that belongs to no one. They tried to make nature conform to 192 national borders and 192 economic agendas. We can't do it. It can't work that way, so long as we are so puffed up, we think that the things that we invent are just as important as the laws of nature. Okay, I spent a lot of time saying the dilemma, the problem that we face, is there a way out? And I see real change, real excitement happening in Latin America. Now, I know in America you don't like to hear this, but Cuba. Cuba is an example where they were deliberately kept out of the global economy by the United States. As long as Russia was there to buy their sugar at premium prices and provide them with all the oil they wanted, they were laughing. It was great. When Russia blew apart, Cuba was in a tremendous dilemma. I mean, they had no oil. They couldn't even bring the food from the countryside into the city. They had no oil. And out of that came this incredible experience where Fidel Castro said, if you see an empty lot in the city and you're willing to grow food on it, take it. If you don't know how to do it, I'll send people to help you. If you don't have the tools, we'll give you the tools. And what came out of that terrible experience for Cuba was this amazing agricultural movement where urban agriculture in Cuba now supplies 80% of the food in Cuba. That is, if you go to Havana, 80% of the food you eat in Havana is grown in Havana. It's fresh, organic, and it's grown by local city dwellers. That's an example that is spreading around the world. But it is Bolivia and Ecuador where I am very, very heartened by what's going on. Bolivia, the poorest country in South America, has elected the first indigenous person as the president of the country, Evo Morales. And Evo is really constantly raising Pachamama, Mother Earth, and saying that we must care for Pachamama because Pachamama is so generous to us, and has done just amazing critiques of the so-called green economy and how this is simply another form of capitalism and that we need to break out of that kind of economic trap that we get caught up in. And in Ecuador, which is an even more amazing experience, Ecuador has a president, Rafael Correa, who was trained, he has a PhD in economics from the United States. And the pride and joy of Ecuador is Yasuni National Park on the east side of the Andes in the headwaters of the Amazon. And for some reason, I won't go into, the Yasuni is the most biodiverse area on the planet. In 1 hectare of Yasuni National Park, they discovered more species of trees than in all of North America, from Mexico to Alaska. Anyway, the Ecuadorians are very, very proud of Yasuni. And a few years ago, they discovered there's oil under Yasuni National Park, $7 billion worth of oil. And Correa said, well, if we dig up the oil, we'll destroy the park. And if we then burn it, we'll simply add to global warming. So we're going to leave that oil in the ground. He said that we're a poor country, huge pressure on us to develop resources, to exploit various parts of nature. We will leave it in the ground, and we will absorb the half of the cost of that oil. That is, we won't go for $3.5 billion. But will the rest of the world help support us to leave that oil in the ground? So they set up a fund in the United Nations. That fund will take the money that comes in, and Bolivia will only take the interest. If a Bolivian government, after Correa leaves, if another government comes in and says, we're going to dig that oil up, we need that oil, then all of that money will go back to the countries that gave the money in the first place. He has asked whether countries will give $300 million a year for the next 10 years. So this is called the Yasuni ITT project. This is the first year they've raised $300 million. So let's hope that they can show that by leading the world in this way, they can actually leave the oil in the ground and yet benefit from that oil in what the country, rest of the world does to keep it, the oil deposited. You know, and it humiliates me to live in one of the richest countries on the planet, Canada, and we just can't wait to dig it out. And we say, oh, yeah, we'll have carbon capture and storage. Wait a minute, nature already did it. The tar sands oil is carbon captured and stored in the ground. Why do you want to dig it up, burn it, and then go, oh, we got to capture it, put it back in the ground. It's already down there. But no, we won't follow a poor country like Ecuador. What Correa did when he was elected, he said, we need a new kind of constitution. So if you elect me, I will revise the constitution. And guess what? In the constitution, they enshrined Pachamama. In other words, what that says is that rivers and forests and fish and birds have a constitutional right to exist. Now you can say, this is an economist, for heaven's sakes. And in the southern part of Ecuador is a river called the Vilcabamba River. And it's reputed to have special powers so that people that live on that water live longer. So naturally, there are a lot of Americans gone down there to live because they think, oh boy, I'm going to find long life. Anyway, one of the One of the American couples that lives on the Vilcabamba noticed a couple of years ago that a road building company was dumping all of the gravel and sand and boulders into the river. And it was causing the river to narrow, so the water was flowing much more quickly. And then there was a big rain, and that water shot around and flooded and destroyed their plantation and much of their property. So they were, as you might expect, mightily upset. So they kept asking the officials to do something. Nothing happened. So they then sued, because Pachamama is guaranteed under the Constitution. They sued the road building company on behalf of Pachamama, the river. Now, because they're suing for the river, they can't claim any money. But what they can claim is the right for that river to exist. They won their suit, and that road company now has to restore the river to its original condition. Not bad. And so I think it's very interesting that in Latin America, there are many, many things going on, including in Colombia, in Peru, in a number of countries, some very, very exciting new ways of looking through lenses that are not driven by economics. And finally, I will just mention, because I've gone on long enough, I would just mention this tiny kingdom of Bhutan. And I'm sure most of you have heard of Bhutan. Today there are 500,000 people living in this kingdom that is surrounded by the Himalayan mountains. Now they're squeezed by these two giants, these behemoths of China and India. And in order to keep from becoming political pawns between these two countries, they just hunkered down behind the mountains. So for literally centuries, nobody knew that Bhutan existed. So now people think of Bhutan as the Shangri-La, you know, this magical kingdom. But they were just doing their thing as farmers and living as they always did. In 1961, they realized that something, the world was changing, and they had to find out what was going on. So they selected 100 kids at random and sent them out to schools in India to be educated, and then sent to schools like Oxford and Cambridge, Harvard and Stanford. And they came back and they began to send hundreds and hundreds of kids out to be educated in the real world. And when they came back to Bhutan, they said, it's really weird. They're all operating out there in the real world on this idea that development is all about growth in the GDP and stuff. Like, they were shocked at this fact. And they said, we don't want that kind of a, that's not what we think development is. Of course we need development, but just stuff, that's not what we want. In 2006, the king of Bhutan, who was greatly loved by his people, said, you know, it's a very dangerous thing when you have a hereditary kingship. Because you never know whether some guy is born in the family, and just because he's born in the right pedigree, he gets to be king. He might be a total jerk. You need to have democracy, because if you elect your leaders and he turns out to be a dud, you can boot him out. Just get him out in the next election. So he said, I quit. And the people were upset, and they said, why? And he said, because I want you to ensure that you don't have this bad experience. But he said, you know, the reason kings and governments exist is to ensure the well-being and the happiness of people. It's not about stuff or growth in the economy or any of that. And in April 2 this year, Jigme Tinley, the Prime Minister of Bhutan, went to the United Nations and introduced the only resolution Bhutan has ever introduced at the UN, that well-being of all life and happiness be the goal of governments. And this was immediately signed on up. 68 countries signed up immediately. But they said, well, what does it mean to be happy? You know, we think of happiness as this kind of joyous, oh, God, I feel great. And, you know, I just went skiing and I feel... No, that's not what he's talking about. It's a much deeper thing about, you know, feeling content or satisfied or having a great sense of place in society and in the things you do. I mean, people said, you've got to define what it is in terms that any people would understand. What is well-being of life? What is happiness? How do you measure it? And how do you develop a strategy for governments to work towards that? And they've set up 4 working groups to work on various aspects of well-being and happiness. And they're all charged with completing their work in 2 years, at which time Bhutan will present this as a full-blown recommendation to the United Nations. And for me, who has long battled in the environmental movement, I believe this is the game changer. This is the paradigm shift. In fact, their submission is a new paradigm of development. And this gets us off the idea that the economy is everything. It's the goal or the end. No, the economy has to be a means of getting to some higher end. And this one, I believe, could be one. So there is opportunity there to begin a radical shift in the way that we see the world. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the boss.
Thank you. Wow, really? Interesting. What an opportunity. Moving in compelling words, David, every time I hear you speak, it's always so interesting for me, you know, as somebody that believes in dragons and demons. I'll say this, though, that you know, when we look at the partnership that is so necessary between traditional ecological knowledge and Western science in terms of targeting, you know, global crises like the end of the era of cheap energy and the loss of natural capital to sustain this insane industrial scientific experiment of the free market and, of course, climate change. I think your words really resonate with me. You know, one thing that I would add to the list of fundamentally sacred things that we need to protect, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, of course, are, you know, indigenous peoples in general and our language. And the reason I bring this up is because as you went through the list of water and the biosphere, what we refer to as the sacred, you know, I was reminded of some words that I heard from a storyteller by the name of Simon Bracope. His brother actually lives in Tsuki Pueblo. And he wrote once in a writing that he put that, you know, across the world there are 350 million indigenous peoples. They are concentrated in the places where the most purest water still exists, where the ecology is still healthy. You know, these are the places that our people are making their last stand. And that every time an indigenous language is lost, that it's like the burning of the library at Alexandria, and we lose an incredibly sophisticated understanding of the ecology of that one particular place that Creator put our people. Because as oral languages, you know, we have no written history, so our very words, our songs, our hunting and gathering practices, our agricultural practices, are vessels of our collective knowledge in terms of how to, you know, be a part of that sacred circle of life instead of separate and above it, controlling it. And so, you know, with that, I just wondered, what are your thoughts on that as we move into this time of extremes, you know, extreme energy, extreme climate change, extreme war? You know, where do the indigenous peoples come in, you know, and what are your thoughts on their role in this process of building the world's largest social movement?
They're at absolute the forefront of the whole movement. I didn't say at the beginning, I normally do, that everything I'm talking about has really been taught to me by First Nations people in Canada, Aboriginal people around the world. I've been a student ever since I began to realize that our paradigm, the one that I was really profoundly influenced by, was scientific reductionism. I was trained as a geneticist. As a geneticist, I was focusing on the DNA and chromosomes of fruit flies. Mm-hmm. I couldn't care less about fruit flies or where they lived. We used to call them flying bags of chromosomes. And we used to, we were interested in focusing because a reductionist assumption is that if you focus on bits and pieces of nature, then eventually, if enough parts are understood, we can fit them back together like a giant jigsaw puzzle or a clockwork mechanism. Mm-hmm. And what Rachel Carson did was she just banged me on the head when I read that book, because it said, yeah, scientists, you're very clever. You can make DDT and show it kills insects. But the lab is not the real world. You're not studying a miniature replica of the real world. You're studying an artifact. Mm-hmm. Because in the real world, it rains. The sun shines, at night falls, wind blows. You spray to kill insects in a field, and you end up affecting fish and birds and human beings. And that really was a recognition of the enormous, profound limitation of the reductionist approach. Mm. And for me, it was a real dilemma until I came and met the Haida people in what used to be called the Queen Charlotte Islands, just off the panhandle of Alaska. And there, they taught me that you are who you are. You are created by the birds and the trees and the water and the air, and all of that is what makes you who you are and in that place. Mm-hmm. And as you say, language is a huge part of that recognition of a lot of the ideas, the principles of that place. That knowledge is priceless and irreplaceable mm-hmm. by science. Mm-hmm. And I grieve at every loss of a language mm-hmm. because of what has been built over thousands of years of observation and experience is lost when you lose that language and that culture. And yet, if you look at the west coast of British Columbia, there are nine nations mm-hmm. through whose territory the government wants to build a pipeline from the Alberta tar sands. Now, these nations are unbelievably poor, these villages. And when you visit them, the first thing they'll say is, look, we've got chronic high levels of unemployment. We need jobs. We need community economic development. Mm-hmm. You can bet Enbridge has offered them millions of dollars to let them build the pipeline through their territory.
One-tenth stake.
And not one nation has said yes. So what is that telling us? The message to me is there are things far more valuable than money. Mm-hmm. Their territory, their culture, their history, their language is not for sale. Mm-hmm. And I thank those remnants that are there. I thank them. I thank you. Because we're going to, you know, after all that's been done to Indigenous people around the world, mm-hmm. I believe we go back to you and say, teach us. Teach us how to make that shift.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, as we did talk backstage, you know, about what we would talk about here, and of course, you know, inspired by your presentation, and that one thing we did agree on was that, you know, we need to flip the leadership of these social movements. You know, we need to lift up traditional ecological knowledge. We need to lift up Indigenous peoples to the forefront of the movement. You know, I would also put into that, you know, it is these times and these problems we face. I think it's going to take a little pinch of Western science, a little pinch of traditional ecological knowledge, and of course, the blessing of the great mystery to get to that next place. But I have faith. You know, you talked in your presentation about happiness-based gross domestic, you know, product. You talked about Bataan.
Gross domestic happiness.
Gross domestic happiness. You know, and this is something I think that, you know, we at the Indigenous Environmental Network and the hundreds of communities that we work with, that we often talk about, you know, and not just to our own people, but to everybody that we meet in terms of our allies. And you know, the last 20 years of our work has really been about, you know, trying to create space for people to reevaluate what has been damaged most by this economy, by capitalism, you know, by this emptiness that we're filled with and that we try to fill with products, you know. And, you know, I wanted to know, you know, would you say that what you're talking about is about reevaluating our relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth?
Absolutely. But, you know, you've had hundreds of years of occupation and colonization. Mm-hmm. So that, of course, a lot of Aboriginal people have bought into mm-hmm. what the dominant society says. So there's a constant, you know, I tend to look to the elders mm-hmm. as the residue of culture that remains. They're mm-hmm. still the keepers, mm-hmm. but they're diminishing in numbers, and often for various nations and tribes, there's got to be a rediscovery from within the community as well mm-hmm. about those values. I wrote a book called The Wisdom of the Elders, mm-hmm. and what it was an attempt to show that Indigenous knowledge is completely congruent with the latest cutting-edge science. Mm-hmm. That these are not exclusive areas mm-hmm. or in conflict. They are congruous. I wanted to give greater credibility to this knowledge. And when I toured Canada with this book, I was shocked because half my audiences were Native people. And young kids would come to me and say, you know, I am so glad to see this book because you're telling me that the things my granny was telling me, those are important. And they, you know, they have to rediscover the value because they themselves, the young people, are not putting as much faith or weight on what they're told by their elders.
Well, you actually flew up to northern Manitoba with one of my staffers during that tour, so that was a really great contribution. You know, you talked about the solutions that we need to come up with, you know, in terms of reevaluating, you know, what is our values, you know, and for me, When I travel and I talk to people and you know, try to inspire them to take action, you know, I talk a lot about extreme energy and I talk about climate change and, of course, the Canadian tar sands. And I spent a long time in the North Slope in Alaska working with the Gwech'en on Anwar as well and seeing the patterns, you know, of the same neo-colonial kind of waves coming into our territories, you know, our Indigenous people's territories. And I wanted to get your thoughts on today's movement. You know, you labeled yourself in this as, you know, being somebody that has been a fighter for many, many decades in the environmental movement. And as a young person, you know, something that I've observed and that I've been a part of being an architect of is trying to facilitate convergence between social movements and trying to break down the silos. And, of course, a lot of that is coming from my own teachings from my elders about the interconnectedness of life, the interconnectedness of our communities, about these ridiculous medicine lines they call borders and how Mother Earth don't give a rat's ass about that. And, you know, there's been mass actions against the tar sands. You know, over 2,000 people arrested at the White House, the largest act of civil disobedience since the Vietnam War on the steps of the White House over the Canadian tar sands. Subsequently, a month later, 12,000 people surrounded the White House again, five rows deep, shoulder to shoulder. A month later, 2,000 people on the steps of our own Canadian Parliament with over 200 people that got arrested protesting the tar sands. 3 weeks ago, Victoria, the Parliament of British Columbia, 7,000 people converged, you know, on the lawn there in Victoria protesting the pipelines and the tankers in BC, the tar sands tankers and pipelines. A few days later after that, thousands of people in 64 municipalities in British Columbia took action in streets in all the communities all across BC and First Nations and non-Native communities alike. And so as somebody that has kind of seen it all, you know, what I'm curious about, you know, is that when I talk about climate change, you know, I talk about it as a global issue that's rooted in social inequity. And I describe it, especially to young people, as the civil rights issue of our generation, you know. And, you know, quite often when I talk about social movement change theory, I talk about the importance of being rooted in an anti-colonial, anti-racist, anti-oppression framework, and that those agreements need to be made on the forefront because of the fact that in my youth, I've seen so many great coalitions fail because of these systems of oppression that pop up and just fracture everything. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, this diversity of tactics that has emerged, civil disobedience, like nonviolent direct action, lobbying, litigation, you know, all of these different pieces. And what are your thoughts on that? Do we escalate?
You've just recited what to me is a pretty impressive list of demonstrations, arrests, and so on. But, I mean, we have to be brutally frank. How much of an impact did 2,000 people have in this country? Did you ever hear a word mm-hmm. from either Obama or Romney mm-hmm. about the issue of climate change or the fact that Americans are caught up? I wonder how many people in the audience have ever heard about these demonstrations and arrests going on in Canada. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just think if you're talking about a mass movement, it hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, you know, I was one of the signatories of the call for people to indulge in civil disobedience in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be much more than that. But we've got to take this crisis seriously. Now, I'm encouraged by the fact that Mr. Obama, a day later, has now mentioned climate a number of times. So, mm-hmm. you know, at least he's kind of put it back on the agenda. But let me say, I think environmentalism has failed as a movement because it's become a kind of specialty. It's being led by people in the environmental movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of young people come to me and say, David, how do I become an environmentalist? I want to save the planet. And I say, well, first of all, the planet isn't in any trouble. Don't worry about the planet. The planet's going to do fine. But then I say, environmentalism is not a discipline or a specialty. Environmentalism is a way of seeing the world. And I say, follow your heart. What do you like to do? Because we need garage mechanics and plumbers and carpenters and teachers and doctors, and we need everybody to see the world through that lens. It's not a specialty. What we have failed in the environmental movement is to embrace a much broader spectrum mm-hmm. of society. You see, to me, someone who's hungry and comes across an edible plant or animal is not going to go, oh, I better consult the red list and see if this is an endangered. They're going to kill it and eat it. I would.
Yeah.
So if you don't deal with hunger and poverty, forget about the environment. Hunger and poverty are my issues.
Well, see.
And it's the same for how people live. If you have chronic high levels of unemployment, mm-hmm. if you live in a society where there's no chance for justice or greater equity or security, if you're constantly threatened with genocide, terror, or war, you're under threat and you have priorities that are not about the environment. So those are our issues.
Well, last we ran into each other, I seen you and you were with Severn, your daughter, and the newest grandchild who had the best hair, I just got to say. Just curly, curly hair and chubby, chubby cheeks. And we were outside the Rio Center at the Earth Summit in Rio, the third Earth Summit. And, you know, you bring up hunger and poverty. And, of course, Cargill and Monsanto have thoughts on hunger and poverty, as do Big Oil, and as do, you know, organizations like the World Bank and the investors in the World Bank, like G8 countries. And, you know, it's interesting when we look at what happened at Earth Summit and the whole launching of this new economic paradigm, this green economy, and programs like the World Bank REDS initiative, which, of course, is a very controversial program. Some people are for it, some people
you
are against
what
it.
REDS is.
Yeah, REDS stands for Reducing Emissions Through Degradation and Deforestation, and it's a forest offsets initiative that the World Bank has put on the table. And there are a lot of indigenous peoples and forest-dependent peoples, particularly in the global south where the World Bank operates, that see this as nothing more than a privatization scheme aimed at privatizing over 66 million indigenous peoples and forest-dependent peoples' lands to become commodities to be bought and sold and traded on the International Carbon Facility of the World Bank. Now, up north in places like the tar sands, where Cree and Dene and Métis people continue to live off the land, but in a very under severe stress because of the immensity of the project, the incredible contamination that's happening on a regional level, are concerned also about these types of market-based approaches to mitigating climate change, because they'll actually enable countries like Canada, who invest in the World Bank, to say, hey, we just planted 1 million trees in Uganda, let's expand the tar sands. And so, you know, I think that what's so insidious about this green economy thing is that the way they're selling it to people around the world and the way they're selling it to indigenous peoples in the South is not only are we going to stop climate change, but we're also going to pay you to continue to take care of your forests. What they don't tell them, though, is that those forests could potentially be cut down and palm trees could be planted or sugarcane, or they don't talk about necessarily biodiversity in the mix. And they also don't talk about the fact that the World Bank has a long history of using military force to remove people from their lands for clean projects. And the Kalahari Wind Project is a perfect example. It was a clean development mechanism project. 300 people got killed to basically get them out of the way for a massive wind farm that would power up a gold mine. And this is World Bank, you know. So what I'm wondering from you then is, what are your thoughts on, as this green economy propaganda emerges, how do we deal with the immense force that, you know, the Monsantos, the Cargills, the Big Oil, King Coal are continuing to push out there? Because when I look at the green economy that has emerged, it's just patchwork on the Titanic, you know, and the freaking boat should never have been built in the first place. And in my opinion, we just got to let that shit sink. So, you know.
Well, I think I agree that it's the economic system itself. So you can have all kinds of good examples of companies, Patagonia, Ben & Jerry's, The Body Shop, Interface Carpets, that are trying to do the right thing, to reduce their footprint and not be so destructive. But they're still stuck in the same economic paradigm. If they don't have a business plan in which you're continuing to grow, you're considered dying. Mm-hmm. You know, growth is built into these plans as necessities. Yeah. So you're stuck with a system that is based on a cancerous model of development, constant growth, and which essentially ignores the services that nature actually performs to keep the planet healthy and survival and livable for us. So there are fundamental flaws in the economic system. And to me, the challenge is getting that thing back into some kind of congruence with the actual places where we live mm-hmm. on the planet. How do you do that? Well, you can try these mechanisms, which I agree with you. I think that carbon offsets, and I have to admit, I fly a lot. Mm-hmm. I buy gold-plated carbon offsets, mm-hmm. which is not reducing my carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. It gives me a bit of salve to my conscience. I've got all kinds of ways to justify flying, but it's not reducing as I and everybody else has to do. Mm-hmm. But I think that there may be the opportunity to get the right things in place by having carbon offsets, but we have to ultimately confront the destructive economy itself. How do you do that? Well, to me, 2008 was the opportunity. Mm-hmm. We have to confront the fact that this economy can't keep growing forever. Now, I've been touring Canada with Jeff Rubin, mm-hmm. who was the senior economist with one of the major banks in Canada for 20 years. And he's just written a book called The End of Growth. And I'm, you know, ever since the Club of Rome came out with limits to growth, environmentalists have been running around saying you can't have an economy that grows forever. And people go, you're just a bloody environmentalist. What do you know about economics?
Right.
So I've been touring with Jeff, and he tells you, hey, it's come to an end. It ain't going to grow anymore. And then I can come along and say, okay, now let's start looking at what can we do. We need that crisis to confront the reality that this system is broke and it can't be fixed. I would have thought the United States is there.
Yeah.
Here's the biggest economy on the planet, and most of you, it is owned by China. I mean, if that doesn't have implications, I can't imagine.
Well, that's a perfect segue, actually, to my next question that I had for you, you know, and I mean, you say the economy is broke. I mean, I would push back, you know, respectfully and say that I think it's working just the way it was meant to. I think it was designed that way. It's a predator economy. It's a linear economic model. And, you know, we need something else. I agree with you on that. But I think it is, I often hear that the economy is broke. And, you know, I think it was designed that way. This is free market economics. It's cannibalistic, it's predatorial, and, you know, it is what it is.
Jeff Rubin's thesis is, as long as you've got cheap oil, the economy purrs like a kitten, runs beautifully. The minute that you get oil spiking, you run into trouble. Now, we've had a number of recessions in the past 40 years. Mm-hmm. Once in 1973 because OPEC deliberately turned off the spigots. And Americans should remember how frightening that was. In 2012, dollars, oil went up to $150 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And you remember Americans lining up at the gas pump, and it was very scary. In a typical American fashion, people started shooting each other, lined up waiting to get their gas.
You know, yeah.
That's the American solution. But he says that another time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, mm-hmm, and set on fire half the wells, and you got a spike in price, and we went into a recession. Mm-hmm. And over again, those recessions have been induced because of war or deliberate turning down the tap. Yeah. This one is different. The price of oil is not going to go down. Mm-hmm. And the reason is we've got all of the easy-to-get oil. Mm-hmm. And now it's getting more and more extreme. We've got to go deeper and deeper into the ocean. We've got to go deeper and deeper into the soil. We've got to get tar sands, shale oil. We've got to go to obscure places like Venezuela, the Orinoco. And this oil is not coming down.
Well, they're approving tar sands projects in Utah, for crying out loud. The most water and energy-intensive type of oil development in the desert. So, yeah, we're definitely living in extreme times. But I want to take us back real quick here to, you know, I guess I want to go up to a more 70,000-foot perspective. You know, as we talk about energy, as we talk about climate change, food security, you know, and all the inequities that are within that, you know, and everything else that we've brought up this evening, that you've brought up, you know, and you just mentioned China. We know, especially when we look at countries like Germany, that when they say that we can't do it in terms of renewable energy, that they're just full of BS, you know, and that what we can't do is continue to consume in an American style, you know, American-centric style, but that the energy's there. The sun provides enough, the wind provides enough, the tides provide enough. There's been a lot of China bashing. I don't know how it is here in the U.S., but in Canada, there has been a lot of blame China stuff that's going on that's bordering on...
I thought we're embracing China. We want them to invest in Canada and the tar sands.
Absolutely. Maybe, you know, private sector, big oil, for sure. But in terms of the climate debate, you know, I'm talking about our circles. Even in British Columbia, there's been some avatars on Facebook saying, stop the Chinese pipeline. And there's some accuracy to that with the new, you know, bilateral trade deal our prime minister signed with China, giving them the right to sue, you know, if they can't get their tar sands investments out of Alberta, you know, which is insane. But I wanted to ask you, though, you know, like when we look at the historical contribution to the global climate crisis and definitely the per capita contribution to climate, you know, Americans and Canadians, hands down, the worst. I mean, an average Canadian puts more CO2 in the atmosphere than an African family of 10, you know. And so what I wanted to know is, as we kind of confront internally things going on in the U.S. and in Canada, how do we avoid getting into these, what I perceive as borderline, you know, xenophobic kind of paintings of the BRIC countries, you know, India, Brazil, and China, these emerging economies, you know, because in my understanding, you know, the reason that they're using the dirty technologies they're using comes down fundamentally to a tech transfer issue. You know, technology wasn't transferred from the north. But maybe you have a different assumption. And I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we had the explosion in Western economies because of technology and our exploitation of cheap energy. And we set the example for the rest of the world. Now, I was at Kyoto in 1997. Mm-hmm. And India and China were there. And everyone agreed, especially the industrialized countries. We had created the problem. It was our industrial growth and use of fossil fuels that had created the problem of climate change. We're producing more than can be absorbed. And it was our responsibility then, because in 1997, we were the major contributor, for us to cap our emissions and bring it down a tiny amount, 6%, mm-hmm, by 2012. Everyone agreed that the industrial countries would sign on, and countries like China, India, Brazil, Indonesia would be allowed to grow their economies and contribute increase their production.
Contraction and convergence.
The minute Kyoto was over in Canada, the argument went, wait a minute, what kind of an agreement is that? China and India aren't even in this agreement. It's not fair. We agreed, for God's sakes, at Kyoto that we would not include them. Mm-hmm. But we had to set the example. Then Canada's argument was, we're only 2% of global emissions. Yeah, but we're only 0.4% of global population. Don't you think, maybe we're a bit of overproducers? And we had all these arguments, and I kept saying, look, we're setting the example. Our economy now is beyond anything they know in India or China. Mm-hmm. And if we, the richest country in the world, can't say we're going to cap and bring it down, why should they even listen to us, for heaven's sakes? And, of course, it's suicidal if they don't listen and do something themselves. The reality is China is one of the leading countries in the green economy. Mm-hmm. They produce 9 out of 10 solar panels, becoming a global leader in windmill production. China sees not only the opportunity in the green economy, but the necessity, because they're killing hundreds of thousands of Chinese, which is still a drop in the bucket, but hundreds of thousands of Chinese through pollution. Mm-hmm. They got a real problem, environmental problem.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's been mass protests actually in the region where the photovoltaics are being produced because of poisoning of the rivers. And, you know, I mean, it is a field of 10 factories lined up. It's just unbelievable. I want to bring us around full tilt. We are getting close to the end of the evening, but I want to bring us back to the rights of Mother Earth. You talked about Bolivia. You talked about Ecuador. You know, for us, I think so many indigenous peoples have been so inspired by evil, you know, being elected to lead, you know, a country. Sure, they're the poorest, but, you know, by what measure, you know? Definitely not by Bhutan's measure. But, you know, a year ago, Evo, along with a host of prominent environmentalists and environmental justice leaders, including our director from IEN, Tom Goldtooth, submitted the rights of Mother Earth to the United Nations. And I guess for me, what I wanted to get some final thoughts from you. As we move into this era where in Ecuador and, you know, in places like Aotearoa, New Zealand, there are entities of the sacred, rivers, mountains, that are being given rights that humans have within the legal constructs of our society. You know, and the way I react to that is, what a great counterbalance to this BS corporate personhood stuff they got in America. You know. And one thing I just want to bring to you, you know, you bring up reductionism. And one thing that we deal with all the time as indigenous peoples is reductionism in the movement. People that say, you know, oh, we're all in this boat together, you know, yada, yada, yada. You know, and when we look at what's going on right now in New York City and who's, you know, still got no power, who's most vulnerable, when we did the same analysis of New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina and Rita, who's most vulnerable? You know, even with this last storm, there's not a mention of what happened in the Caribbean, you know, islands in that whole region, you know, from the same storm, you know, and the devastation there in our media. And so I bring up, I guess, you know, as we move into this time when we're trying to influence and raise up the rights of Mother Earth, what are your thoughts on the necessity and importance of the human rights-based approach within our current work? Because there are still many uneven playing fields and also disproportionate impacts when we talk about climate change, when we talk about extreme energy, you know, when we talk about, you know, what Monsanto and Cargill are doing to our food systems. There are communities which tend to be racialized, at least in North America, or communities in the South. Sure, there's some low-income white folks in there, too, in North America. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, raising Native folks up to the forefront to lead the movement, I also think about all of our other communities that we've worked with through the civil rights movement and all these other things. And I just want to know, you know, where you sit, you know, as an elder of our movement, how do we keep that balance and not lose sight of the fact that there are still very real pieces in terms of trying to just have equality, you know, and try and flip that power paradigm.
Do we have 5 hours?
Just final thoughts.
Well, our foundation, which is a small organization, sees its next big project, well, it started now, is to try to get a constitutional amendment. And this is still an anthropocentric way of approaching it, but we're trying to enshrine the right to a healthy environment in our constitution. And it sounds, you know, like it sounds like a motherhood issue, except when you look at what is a healthy environment. You can't have a healthy environment for people without Pachamama being healthy and flourishing. So it's a very subversive way, I think, of making us face the fact of our relationship with the rest of creation for our well-being. So this is one small initiative which I hope will become a big movement in Canada. And we want this to be as big a tent as possible. So as I say, a lot of these issues of social justice, of hunger and poverty, they've got to be in the tent with us, the right to a healthy environment. So that's one small way that we're approaching it. But quite frankly, I think if we can't bring this behemoth, the global economy, if it doesn't somehow collapse, that's going to be the trigger to the really big changes. So we're still going to have to do it in bits and pieces wherever we are. I don't know much about it, but I'm intrigued by what's called in England the Transition Town Movement.
I'm very familiar with Transition Towns.
Which is much more of a trying to become locally self-sufficient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of examples, too, in North America, like transition towns that are emerging. But yeah, the whole localization movement, I mean, I definitely am a big supporter of that as well. I'm afraid that our time for conversation is coming to an end, though, this evening. But I want to just say what a pleasure it is to share the stage with you and also with all of you here in Santa Fe. And I just want to express, you know, great thanks to our host, the Lannan Foundation, for giving Dr. Suzuki and I.
Thank you.
Dr. Suzuki, is there any website or Twitter feed that you want to let people know to go to?
Well, the David Suzuki Foundation is just Google that and you'll find all you need.
For us, Indigenous Environmental Network, IENEarth.org, Google Indigenous Environmental Network. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. We love the social media thing, so hit us up. And we'll see you all in the streets.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.